And when I got there, these artifacts were silver coins that were wedged in between the reef system. And I remember being so absolutely fascinated with the fact that these small coins could have stayed on this site for hundreds of years when the rest of the reef is sort of worn away by the swell and the force of the ocean. And I remember working in between swell sets, and you'd have to wedge yourself into this crevice to work on it, and the swell would come and you'd brace yourself in the crevice and feel your mask kind of pull off your face and then hit back on your face in the swell. And that really stuck with me because it was kind of a crazy dive to be sort of thrown in swell on a reef system and feeling the force of the ocean that I'm sure is there 95% of the time, and yet realizing that these wrecks can be there for a long time and they can survive there, and we can still find new sites on incredibly dynamic ocean systems. That was a really crazy moment for me.
Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to season 2 of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid. Intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet. Hey mermaids, what's going on? I am ecstatic about our next interview. I really hope that you're ready for this because we're about to talk about something we've never spoken about on this podcast, which is maritime archaeology. Have you ever thought about that? Like, what does it take to look at artifacts underwater and tell a whole story just based on objects that have been underwater for years, if not hundreds of years? We're here to speak to Dr. Madeline McAllister, who specializes in just this. She has her PhD and works in Australia and does so many cool things that I cannot wait for you to hear about. So, Madeline, welcome to the show, aka Maddie, aka the Shipwreck Mermaid. I love that, by the way. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Danny. Thank you so much for having me. I'm pretty excited to be on a 21st Century Mermaids podcast as the Shipwreck Mermaid.
It's perfect. It's so perfect. Like, your Mervitar is going to be epic. Like, we never had a shipwreck scene in the Mervitar background. It's going to look beautiful. Excellent. Well, let's start off with your origin story. Bring us back to the beginning. When was this idea present in your mind when you decided, yeah, I want to be a marine archaeologist?
Yeah, I wanted to be a marine biologist, actually. I had this wild idea that I wanted to go and work in Antarctica and study I don't even know, marine mammals down in Antarctica. And that's what I thought I would do in my early high school years. And then I also had a long fascination with like ancient Egypt and, you know, ancient sort of worlds. And I figured out one day that you could actually combine both of those and I could do underwater things that looked at the ancient or the historical world. And I knew that pretty early. I'm one of those annoying people that knew in like when I was 15 that that's what I wanted to do, and I followed it. Yeah.
Awesome. And I mean, I can totally relate to that story of wanting to be a marine biologist to study marine mammals. I think that is like the number one dream for at least 90% of the world at some point in their lives.
Which is understandable, but that's the beauty of ocean science or anything related to ocean science. It's like there are so many different options that you can pick from. So because of your interest in Egyptology or looking at the past and that time of human history, was that really the main thing that made you think, okay, I should explore this?
Actually, it was really... Actually, it's kind of a dorky story. I was in year 10, I think. So that's like 15 years old, in Australia. And my Christmas present had been to get my scuba diving ticket. So I was a fresh scuba diver. I lived on in a little coastal tourism town in the southwest of Western Australia, and my stepdad came home from work one day and he'd heard on our local ABC radio that there would be a curator from the local museum there to give us a lecture on shipwrecks at our RSL, which is our Retired or Returned Services League. So I dragged my mum along to it that night, and to say we were the youngest people in the room by about 40 years isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah. And this guy, Ross Anderson, who I know very well today from the West Australian Museum, gave this wonderful lecture on all of these shipwrecks that were around my local town and my local beach and just off the coast that I had no idea were there. And I realized that this is something that you could do as a job. You could study shipwrecks and learn about shipwrecks, and you could dive and be in the water. And it was just this incredible sort of aha moment of, that's what I want. I want to do that. Yeah.
Wow. At 15 years old, you knew that. Amazing. I mean, that speaks to the testament of mentors and role models, how important it is just to have that moment, even if it's just one moment, one event, it could change the course of your entire life.
Yeah. And those, you know, sometimes I think we think those public lectures or things that you might do yourself now aren't ever going to have a big impact. You know, they're not conferences, they're not academic lectures. This was a small local town and it made such an impact on me. So that I'll always do those now and I'll always support those because I think they're really important.
That's so amazing. What I think I love most about your field is that you're looking at human interactions, really, the stories that humans have told over the centuries. And their experiences in, out, and around the water. What has been one of the most interesting or maybe startling things that you've found in your work?
Oh, there's so many. Some part of me is just drawn to the ocean. And I think that we all are, right? If we're interested in the ocean or whether it's coral or fish, there's some part of us that just loves being out there. And I really love learning about why humans have wanted this for so long and what humans 200 years ago or 500 years ago or thousands of years ago felt or loved about being on the ocean. So when you find those clues from something that is far, far older than you of these people, it's such a moving and haunting thing. Maybe the one that has impacted me the most recently actually is a scuba dive on a very famous shipwreck just off my local home here off Townsville called SS Yongala. And it is kind of like, I would call it Australia's Titanic, so that people kind of understand what sort of wreck it is. It's a 100-meter long steel ship that sunk and completely disappeared during a cyclone with every single person on board. So 122 people disappeared overnight. They never found it in 1911, so around the time of Titanic, and they never found it until the 1950s. So it was this complete mystery for a long time. And it sits about 60 kilometres off the land. It's a famous tourist site. It's one of the top wreck dives in the world. And you can go out there and dive it. It's in 30 metres of water, but it's in the middle of a sandy plain. So it's like this desert of sand, and all of a sudden there's this 100 meter long, 15 meter high ship structure. So it has drawn all this marine life from everywhere. It's absolutely incredible, from giant sea snakes and rays and sharks to a Queensland groper that is nicknamed V-Dub because it's so big, it's the size of a small car.
V-Dub, I love it.
I don't go too close to her. I think she easily eat you in one bite. But for me, and I love diving with, I always dive with my friends who are coral scientists or fish scientists, and it's funny to see them absolutely enthralled with the marine life. And I spend the entire time looking at the ship and the structure. And there's one bit towards the stern, the ship is sort of sitting on its left side. And right up towards the stern, if you know what you're looking for, you can look through this gap or this hole in the hull straight into the second class bathroom. And it's kind of on a slope, but there's this beautiful clawfoot bath still sitting there on the floor. It just looks incredible. And it's such a haunting moment because you know that 122 people died. They were never ever seen again. And you have this literal window into a shipwreck, into the past. And for some reason, a bathtub is just such a, I don't know, like a normal thing that really you recognize and becomes familiar. So that's a really haunting thing for me. And it's always such a clear, beautiful dive out there that I'm always reminded of it being a gravesite as well as a shipwreck. So that's the most recent one that really impacted me.
That's powerful. It's incredible. And like to think that 70 years ago, we didn't have the technology to get down and see an artifact like that and to understand what happened. If we didn't, that shipwreck would still be down there and no one would know what happened to that entire vessel and all the people on board.
Exactly. I love that technology is opening so much more to us. I think we're kind of on the precipice of finding out some really fascinating things. And it's a reminder to leave things there too, because we don't know what sort of technology in the future will allow us to do amazing things to these sites without interfering with them in some way too.
So speaking of technology, what kind of technology do you use on a daily basis?
Oh, look, I don't think I can call myself a tech whiz by any means. I'm certainly a classic archaeologist, and we like to cherry pick a bit of this and a bit of that from everyone else's disciplines, and we use all of it together. So I think actually the most amazing thing now, and I use this as part of my PhD, is 3D photogrammetry, so where people are making all of these 3D models out of photos. And to me, that is just amazing because as divers, we know that when you go down to 30 meters depth, you're limited by time. So you don't have as much time as, say, an archaeologist working in Egypt on land who can spend, you know, from sunup to sundown working on a site. We're really limited. And all of a sudden, with just a underwater digital camera, we can record a site in 30 or 40 minutes and not only record it, but create this 3D model. And there's something to 3D that really allows people to get it. Like they get what the shipwreck looks like. They're not just looking at one photo or a photo mosaic in 2D, which doesn't really, you know, if you're not a diver or you've never been underwater, you might not understand the reefscape. So for me, it was really fascinating that all of a sudden we have this powerful tool that allows you to record a site and do your archaeology work, but then also create something that you can show any other person in the world and they have the chance to feel like they have been on the wreck and they can see the wreck in 3D and they get it. And it's really, really amazing. We're doing this all the time now and I'm so impressed that we have something to record these sites in 3D.
Absolutely. I mean, that feeling as a diver, when you descend and then you're going down, like recently I did a couple of wreck dives in the Gulf of Mexico and it was incredible. You get past that line, whether it was a thermocline or a halocline and then, or just, you know, a lot of turbidity in the water where it was just not clear. And then all of a sudden, boom, this wreck is revealed to you. And it is spectacular to see an entire boat, no matter what size, underwater, just sitting on the seafloor. Yeah. It takes your breath away.
It does. Yeah, they just appear out of the gloom. And I think the size you're saying, you know, just really sort of hits you being a diver. You rarely get to see things on a large scale underwater really well. So, yeah, that's amazing.
And I mean, in addition to the vessel itself, as you mentioned, there's a lot of marine life that's living on the wreck and have encrusted the wreck and created an entire reef habitat. What are some of the coolest creatures you've seen on some of your dives?
My favorite at the moment are sea snakes around here. I can't remember what they're called. They're a goldy yellow sea snake and they're quite large, like over a meter long and quite thick. And they just have no fear. I love that sea snakes have no fear of you and they'll like swim through your legs and around and up you and then just keep going or they ignore you completely. I think they're such a crazy animal. The other ones actually Amazingly, because a lot of the sites I work on are quite small, so most of the shipwrecks, like wooden older ones, are very different to Yongala and a lot of the wreck dives that people do. They're sort of bits and pieces strewn across reefs. And the best things are octopus that live, you know, like around anchors or in cannon or under little bits and have really made their home in something. And, you know, you can see their little like strewn bits of crab shells or something out the front of their home. And then they're always in there. And if you're working around something and photographing it or recording it, you can guarantee that they'll come out and check out what you're doing. And yeah, like it's really, they're such an intuitive animal. It's cool to have them live on wrecks, and they live on a lot of wrecks around here. It's really lovely.
So they're just doing a sample collection or excavating, and there you see like two eyes staring at you.
Yeah, it just comes over to see what you're doing. Yeah.
Sounds fun. I love it. Oh my gosh, that's so cool. As a marine archaeologist, what does your daily life look like? Like maybe you're not diving every day, but what's the usual schedule kind of flow of your work?
Yeah, I wish I got to dive every day. I'm sure all of us say that. The reality is a little bit more boring. I do a lot of work in my office. I think I would say for every day I'm out on the water, I have to do 20 days of work behind it. That is anything from planning it to tidying things up to analyzing artifacts to doing historical research. So it's a lot of desk-based work, but I think that's really important because that's where we start to pull all the clues together. Not necessarily while you're out on the water, that's where you're out there collecting the data, but back here is where you do the kind of detective work. So a lot of it is at my desk. Probably one day a week I'm squirreled away in our collection store here, which is our cultures and history storeroom, and it has probably over 20,000 artifacts from shipwrecks and historical diving, but also it houses our First Nations collection here as well. So it's quite a really special place to work in, and it's really fantastic. A lot of museums would only have 2-4% of their collections on display. The rest is downstairs. So that's where I get to do a lot of my work with the things that nobody gets to see.
That's your playground.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That's awesome. Throughout your academic journey and getting to this point as a doctor, as a PhD, how did you go about deciding whether or not to pursue your PhD?
I think I'm only laughing because I think I answered a question on Instagram the other day where I somehow said doing a PhD is soul destroying, and I didn't even think about it, and I had so many people comment on it. So it's great you asked that because I don't think I ever would have thought of myself as going down the lines of being an academic. I always felt that I much prefer being on the water. I liked driving the boats, I liked driving the trucks, and I liked doing a lot of the work that maybe lent me more towards consulting work or doing something else like that. And I actually just happened to be working as an assistant curator at the Western Australian Museum, and I'd finished my master's. I worked there for about 2 years, and the museum and the university there, University of Western Australia, was successful in getting a really large grant that was called Shipwrecks of the Roaring Forties, and it looked at the last 40 years of maritime archaeological work and how we could maybe ask new questions or answer questions we couldn't before with new technology. And it had a PhD place associated with it. So I applied for that because I really liked the thought of what we could do with new technology on old sites, but also I knew that that kind of guaranteed me for 3 years of lots of field work and and doing research. And that's how I ended up doing my PhD. I wouldn't say I ever had that as a goal, but I'm very, very grateful I did it alongside a project like that. I think it was sort of a community and gave me assistance and made you feel part of a bigger project as well. So yeah, that's how I ended up doing that.
I think that's vital to have that kind of sense of place in a project to know that your work is contributing to something much bigger than yourself.
Yeah. I just loved that it was, and some of these people had worked on these sites for 40 years. So I can't imagine what I'll be saying in 40 years' time, if someone is looking at the sites I'm working on now with new technology, I think it'll just blow you away. So it was really cool.
Mm-hmm. So beyond your PhD, what other certifications do you need in order to be a marine archaeologist?
Yeah. So, I mean, a master's or an honors, certainly these days, if you're not going down academia, is a really good academic qualification. I'd like to say that you don't have to dive, but reality is a lot of our work is diving. So scuba ticket is pretty essential and some experience, you know, not just being a fresh scuba certified person and jumping into a project. You kind of have to have all of your diving skills under your belt to then approach the tools and approach the sites really well. So that's something that's really important. And always my advice to people thinking about starting this as a career is, no matter what you do at university, really take the time to get diving every weekend, familiarize yourself with boats and with being out on the water and being a really good deckhand and a dive buddy on top of anything else, because that becomes really important. And I think that applies to marine biology or any sort of ocean science as well, that you kind of have to be a good all-rounder person to do well in the field.
Absolutely. Maddie, what are some of the obstacles that you face besides having to get through these, you know, kind of grueling cert courses for scuba and your PhD? But like, what are some of the nuanced things that you've experienced that were particularly hard to overcome?
The field is so small. And I love everyone in our field, particularly in Australia. Everyone knows everyone and it's kind of like family when you see each other at the annual conference and things like that. But I'm still the rookie, you know, like I'm still with the people that like I first met from the WA Museum and my professors and my supervisors and now my colleagues, and you still are kind of the rookie in many senses. So that kind of... I never thought of that as a problem, and maybe it's not necessarily a problem, but it does sort of mean that I'll have to go the extra mile to prove that I'm not the young one anymore. I do have the PhD. I've got nearly a decade of experience. I'm in a senior role here, and I'm doing my own research, and it's fantastic. So that certainly is one part of it. There's this weird notion that maritime archaeology is a boys' club, like boats are for boys is a great article that I've read. And that may have been true for the 70s, 80s and 90s. I'd say that there's a turning of the tide, which is really fantastic to see women coming up in this field in their own right and being leaders in it, which is really fantastic. Not that, you know, some of my mentors and my really, really good friends are those guys that started the discipline here and paved the way. And they've never put a boundary on me. I always had to do what everyone else did. And that was a really fantastic, you know, to learn from those people. But I think that's something that's really interesting, is that it's sort of a changing of the guard from older white men who ran things and did a fantastic job and have always fostered and nurtured and educated the next generation. But it's wonderful to see that the next generation is much more 50-50. The girls are coming up, which is great.
Yes, so happy to hear that. Because I think each discipline has its own struggles. And to hear that from you is like really heartwarming, but also just like a hell yeah moment, right? Like you just want to like see more women involved in this field. And in 2016, I read that you were awarded a memorial scholarship, the Cecilia Connolly Memorial Scholarship in Underwater Archaeology from the Women Divers Hall of Fame. Speaking of women in the field, what was that like? Was that one of your triumphant moments in your career? And were there any other moments that you feel especially proud of?
100%. I was kind of blown away that I was awarded that. That's a very prestigious award. I know the Women Divers Hall of Fame is prestigious, but then to be awarded the Cecilia Connolly Memorial Scholarship was huge. I had actually learned about it through one of my mentors and friends, Dr. Wendy Van Duivenvoorde, and she was awarded it in her early studies. And I remember seeing it and thinking, that is just so amazing that you can kind of be recognized by this global group of women who were the leaders in every field, not just archaeology, but, you know, ocean sciences and diving and marine technology. So yeah, I applied for it in my PhD and I was blown away that I got it. That gave me some funding to get out to Batavia, which is a Dutch East India shipwreck in the Abrolhos Islands, and complete a really essential part of my PhD fieldwork. So it's a very, very remote location. And yeah, that was essential that I could get out there and record the site. So thank you to them. And they continually support next generation archaeologists with that scholarship. It's just brilliant.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So who else do you consider your mentors?
Oy, I have so many.
The first three that come to mind.
So definitely, yeah, Wendy is absolutely one of them. She's become a really close friend of mine. I first met her when I was doing my undergraduate degree at Flinders University. She's a professor there. And throughout my career, she has provided guidance and advice and pushed you to apply for jobs or, you know, to apply for something that you thought you weren't qualified for or experienced for, and to do it anyway because you might get it. And she does such amazing research. So I'm very grateful to have Wendy as a mentor here as well. My second one is Jeremy Green, who is or was working at the Western Australian Museum, started the program really there in the 1970s. He came out from the UK to excavate Batavia. And he developed a lot of things and really is one of the founding people in Australia for maritime archaeology. And equally, he has always been very generous with his time and inviting me to do things and teaching me, even if I didn't want to be taught, some of the intricacies of remote sensing and surveying for shipwrecks. That's very complicated. So thank you to him as well. Other mentors, I would have to say, I actually am finding new mentors in the last sort of 2 years that I guess wouldn't be your typical ones that you meet in passing or you see through virtual ways. Like, I think COVID really changed a lot of the way that we network, and it opened our networks beyond just our countries or who you see and who you know by person. One amazing actually mentor that I have that I met and found out that she actually came and did her PhD here in Townsville is Erica Woolsey. So Erica, she's helped me with so many things and is familiar with where I'm from, but she is one of these people that I look up to because she's an incredible scientist and she's got a PhD and she does incredible work, but she takes it that next step in terms of communication and public outreach and is doing wonderful things that I hope to be able to do one day as well, just with shipwrecks. But yeah, so it's more, I guess, now meeting mentors that are your same age or near your age that are doing things that really inspire you is how I'm looking at mentors now. Yeah.
Shout out to Dr. Erica Woolsey, one of our three co-founding mermaids of this podcast. Yeah, I could totally sit here and fangirl all day about Erica. She is one of my favorite humans on the planet, and I just admire everything that she creates in the world. And so, Erica, we love you.
We love you.
Oh, my goodness. That's so good. So when it comes to the cultural context, you touched on this a little bit before, but what are some of the other nuances when it comes to the communities that you're maybe interacting with when you're out doing your work? And is there any resistance about excavating a certain site or bringing up, you know, past events that maybe certain communities don't want to see happen?
Yeah, fantastic. I would say that most of the communities I have worked with to date have been sort of your diving clubs and diving communities that get out to these sites and see them and know them and create sort of a level of ownership or custodianship over these wrecks. And that's a really fantastic thing because you can't appreciate them without knowing they're there and seeing them, and to have people that love them for what they are and look after them is really fantastic. Most of the time they're really keen to see archaeologists work on them. They want to know more about them. And as long as it's communicated with them what you're doing and why, then that's really amazing. I would say actually I've just started really expanding my skill set and how I look at shipwrecks off Australia by working with a colleague of mine, Imelda Miller, who's a First Nations curator here at the Queensland Museum. And Imelda is an Australian South Sea Islander, which is a group of people who were brought to Australia from the South Sea Islands anywhere from the sort of mid to late 1800s as indentured labourers, essentially, to work in the cane fields here. And they've had sort of a hidden history. It's been washed over, and Mel is doing incredible work on a project with the communities that are still here and understanding their past on land. And we actually have this incredible shipwreck called Foam, which is off Townsville on the Great Barrier Reef, that wrecked in 1893. And it was taking indentured labourers back from Australia to their home in the Solomon Islands. And it never made it. It wrecked on the reef. And these people lost everything. So they'd worked for 3 years as indentured labourers, which I guess you could say is essentially slave labour. Realistically, it's not often labelled as that, but in honesty, that's what it was. And what little they'd managed to get together to take back with them, they lost completely. So nearly all of them came back and worked again for another term in Australia. And the local community doesn't really know about this. The local South Sea Islander community doesn't know about the site. If they do, they don't understand what's there. It has previously been worked on by white maritime archaeologists who are very well-meaning and have done fantastic research, but it's never been opened up to the public, to South Sea Islanders, to see what they want from a site and how they interpret it and what the future holds for them and what it means for them and their community. So Mel and I have quite literally just brainstormed this, and the whole idea is that we're going to start with the collection that we have here, which is really fascinating. It has bits and pieces of ceramic armbands, for example, that were made by Europeans to take to the South Sea Islands to trade and interpret that with the communities and hopefully build into something bigger where we can eventually one day take them out to this wreck site and they can get in the water and they can see it, or they can just be there and be on the site and understand what it is. And I think that is something that we haven't done in Australia before, or we haven't done very well. We're learning now and we're getting better at how we work.
I'm really glad that you're leading the way in that unveiling, in a way, of that particular site and what it means to the community that impacted the most. And I think that speaks to this idea of cultivating ocean empathy. How do you think we can cultivate more of it from an individual level, but also a communal level?
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for if you can't see it, you don't believe it. Like if you never get the chance to be out there, you'll never understand how amazing it is. So we have to have some way of bringing these places to everybody. And, you know, I think our phones and what we can do with a GoPro today are just the first steps, but there has to be ways where we're better at telling stories, and not all academics can be, and that is completely fine. I'll never be as smart and motivated, I'm sure, as most academics. Their brains are incredible, but maybe what I can do is translate that for them and turn that into something where I know what they're talking about, but I can translate it to something that resonates with community or with people on an individual level.
Amazing. Yeah. So you are a science communicator, period. Yeah. It's so great. And it takes guts to claim that, especially I'm sure with your workload and all the things that you're managing, to add that onto the list of endeavors. I mean, it takes a lot of courage. Maddie, as you know, 21st Century Mermaids podcast is an official activity of the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development, and it supports the full protection of 30% of the ocean by 2030. Can you tell us about how you've contributed to the achievement of this massive goal?
Yes, I wish I've contributed more. I think that within that, and what is often forgotten, is that our cultural heritage is a massive part of that. And I'd say UNESCO and the Decade of Ocean Science is doing a fantastic job at bringing our First Nations and Indigenous communities and their cultural knowledge into the fray and into the picture. I am worried that maybe things like our shipwrecks will be forgotten and left behind. They may have seemed to have had their heyday in the 90s, but we can't work on them and we can't know them without getting out there and working on them and identifying them. So a big part of what I do is really some of those first steps is looking at some of those clues to help us help us identify these wrecks on the reef, for example, that could be incredibly significant and deserve protection, but we just don't know because we haven't done that step yet. So I'd like to say I'm contributing by just doing some of the little bits at the start to get us there towards in the end.
You're absolutely contributing. Yes, cultural heritage is so important to the human experience. And the more that we know what's under the waves, under the surface of the ocean, the better we'll understand our history and to be able to make better choices in the future. I truly believe that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said that way better than I could. That was
good. Oh my gosh. Thank you. Oh, okay. But now for a little more lighter, fun questions. The podcast features different women that we believe embody the spirit of a mermaid, a modern day mermaid. And because you work in the ocean science space and touching in marine conservation fields, what's your interpretation of a mermaid? Like, how do you describe a mermaid in your mind?
Oh, so good. A mermaid in my mind. Someone who is completely at home in the water, like it's a second, you know, like you can walk down the street, you just get in the water and it's easy. That to me is a mermaid. Someone who starts to get cranky if they're away from the water for too long is also a mermaid to me. Needing to wet their gills again is a common thing we say over here. It's been too long. I need to go and wet my gills again.
I love that.
Yeah. I think that a modern day mermaid to me is someone who just absolutely loves the ocean, wants to be in it, wants to be near it, wants to have a career that is somehow involved in it, or purely just loves it on their weekends. I think any of us could be mermaids if that's what we love.
Yes, yes, yes. Couldn't agree more. I love it. And last, your vision of the world, but in particular, the ocean in 2030, if you could have it your way, like to see the ocean come back to whatever you believe it should be, what would that look like?
Gosh, my ocean in 2030. I think, oddly, I'd love to see more people out on the ocean in 2030, but for the right reasons. I'd like to see people that are out there exploring it and recording it and studying it, fishing it and working from it, but in the right way. I think that I'd love to see, yeah, more people out there and somehow embodying like a conservation of the ocean long term. I think we're on our way there, and I'd really, really hope that it'd be like that in 2030.
That's a beautiful vision. Maddie, you're so amazing. Thank you, thank you, thank you, really, thank for you. Making the time to do this.
Oh, no, I love having anyone that will listen to me talk about you for an hour.
Anytime, anytime. No, this was fascinating, seriously. 21st Century Mermaids is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.